Hello and welcome to this discussing episode of the Beyond podcast, a chat with Tamsin Lewis of Passamezzo, a wonderful musician and worker in the trenches of early modern music. This episode was to be shaped slightly differently, mixed in with other material on the play Love's Victory by Mary Roth, but timetables and things shifted around that, so the chat isn't quite as structured as it might have been. And towards the end of the chat, there was a random technical error, so there are a few slightly more non-sequiturish digressions. But it should be an enjoyable and interesting listen anyway. And since recording this chat, Tamsin has produced a book of music. Here comes My Lord Mayor, 17th Century Songs for the Lord Mayor's Show, which was in part inspired by our reconstruction of the 1621 Lord Mayor's Show, where we commissioned Passamezzo to produce some music, a mix of sheet music, lyrics and scholarship. It's a lovely bit of work, and I'm not saying that because of some financial incentive. We might have been the impetus, but this isn't something we produced. Links to Here Comes My Lord Mayor from Rondo Publishing and many things Passamezzo can be found in the show description. But for now, I'm going to pass you over from Future Robert to Past Robert. Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And my special guest here today is going to be talking primarily about early music, the music that they create. In fact, you have heard them before. Yes, on our Lord Mayor's Show reconstruction for 1621, there was much music involved, which definitely made the show, especially considering how miserable a day it was and how difficult it was to produce music outdoors when instruments get wet and voices get cold. So to talk to my guest, I think it's important to introduce them by asking my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hi, I'm Tamsin Lewis. And my purpose in life, that's a big one. I almost don't know where to start. I'm a musician and historian with an interest in all things 16th and 17th century, about the social history behind the music rather than just making a noise, putting it in context. I play a number of early string instruments, primarily violin and rebec, but also viols, lute, harp, and I sing. I'm currently also teaching at the Courtauld Institute on Renaissance music and art. I really enjoy combining music with words, with theatre, working with actors or dancers, working in film, television, adding levels to a story really through the music.
Because we got to know each other because of the Lord Mayor Show reconstruction that we did the other year.
Which had sheep.
In fact, you supplied sheep. We failed to provide our own sheep. So the musicians provided some sheep for us on their instruments. Well, I think it was one of my great failings for that particular show was the lack of additional sheep that were definitely required. And yes, it was wonderful to be able to tell part of that story through music, that you were able to find tunes and songs that were about the Lord Mayor Show as well as appropriate for the event itself. And even though we didn't know for that particular Lord Mayor Show any of the musical cues that might have existed.
No, but one fantastic source of information about historical events, historical performances, is Broadside Ballads, where they give in appalling doggerel verse usually wonderful down-to-earth descriptions of what people are doing, sometimes not very respectfully, sometimes rather in a rather sycophantic way, all depending on who's written it. But it's a good way to get a snapshot into what the performances or events were like. There are ballads describing people setting off fireworks at the Lord Mayor's show, and indeed when this goes a bit wrong as well. There are other ballads talking about all the different livery companies involved. And then there are just ones of a visitor to London coming across this rather strange thing and getting all muddy in the process and probably getting his pocket picked. But it's different aspects of these things.
Yes, because because Beyond does so many different things. In theory, we're primarily about doing plays, but in practice, we're touching on all of the overlapping bits of culture that feed into understanding how the plays function. And music is one of those elements that we haven't really done enough on yet. You know, we're just starting to dip our toe into at least the texts of various either ballads or jigs and elements there. But they all do overlap, and they create a sense of a culture that is in conversation with itself. It's like one of the complaints we always have in play readings is when someone's going off on one about classical literature or elements of forms of history that, you know, we don't really get, or we get in a very rarefied way, but much of which data might have existed in songs, in popular song of the time, and trying to find ways of feeding into that.
Yes, I mean the Greek myths, and indeed parts of history, both English and general world history, are described, and it's an easy way if you've got an audience, a public, most of whom can't read, to have the storytelling element. If you're telling the story in a song, it sometimes helps that to go in better. So the ballads in particular are a way where people would just sit and listen to how Daphne got turned into a tree, Dr. Faustus and how he was torn into many, many pieces by devils. There are ballads to tell all these stories. So in addition to the plays that you would go and see, you could buy a ballad or listen to a ballad which would tell the story of that play.
Mm. And musicianship of the period, I mean, there's an awful lot of people who do play instruments peripatetically as well as in a more professional way as well. I mean, it's not a recorded music culture in the same way as we have today, obviously, where we're surrounded by music and we have playlists and music just comes bombarding at us. But there's an awful lot of musicianship about, isn't there? Am I making that up?
Yes, no, you're not making it up at all. I mean, remember, they've got no television.
Hmm.
Everyone made music. Some people did it very badly, but everyone made music. Whether it was singing rounds as they worked or singing ballads in the tavern, whether it was listening to the town waits, marking out the hours through the night, ringing curfew, whether it's hearing trumpeters in a procession, whether as you get into the Elizabethan era, the Thomas Gresham's concerts that he started, that's probably the first public concerts. And then you would have wandering musicians who would play not particularly posh instruments, because they'd have to play something they could afford to have. It wouldn't be worth stealing off them. And then as you go up the scale, you've got professional musicians playing all sorts of things, from keyboard, strings, brass, woodwind. You've got music in church, and you've got music at court and in the great households, and general culture among those who were educated of learning music, that there are so many books that teach you how to play the lute or how to play the viol or how to sing, how to write music, how to improvise. So that if you've got, because it was considered boring to do the same thing twice. So they would teach you that if something repeats, you can do lots of different things with it. This is where I really need to give you musical examples rather than just talking.
But well, no, I mean, that.
Now I'll just talk about it.
Yes, I mean, and that's sort of actually our progression at the moment, is that we're mostly sort of talking about music and talking about songs and talking our way through songs. We're not really doing any practical work. I mean, what interests me is if you look at the records of early English drama, which are these wonderful tomes of just accounts of any reference to performance, is just, it's almost every page is fined for playing music on Sunday. It's almost every single day someone in the country is having fun with music.
And yet, at the same time, some at harvest time, in summertime, what did they say, from Whitsun to Lammas, many parishes would pay for a piper to play after prayers, not during prayers, at the time when people had already been to church, for people to dance on the green. So there, you know, there is a culture of accessibility, but it's when it is
when it's allowed. I mean, it, it's
when it's allowed and when it's not.
And also because of the period we're talking about here, because we're talking a quite a shift in attitudes to music in different contexts as well, because of course the Reformation's occurring and there are shifts in what kind of music is appropriate for church and the context there, as well as when things happen, and there's quite a scope for change over this sort of century or so we're talking about.
There is as well as just as there is in literature, the musical progressions as styles develop, different instruments come to the fore. It's a time of huge change. And that's even before we start going into the Civil War and Puritan restrictions, although these were less than is popularly considered.
So in practice, I mean, you do a lot of performance, you do a number of events. You've mentioned you've done working with television companies as well as theatre and things. What sort of events and things have you worked on? Where might our viewers, we're a podcast, where might our listeners encounter you?
So in the past, you'll have seen me talking to Lucy Worsley and teaching her to sing, teaching Danny Dyer to sing.
Excellent.
Drinking songs. and Becoming Elizabeth, which is a television series about the young Elizabeth. I provided a lot of music for that. There's a film coming up called Firebrand, and I directed the music for that. Mm-hmm. You'll see me playing, but also see the actors who I taught to play instruments. Most recently, I was working with the University of Lancaster on a wonderful play, a play by a woman called Love's Victory, which was, it's written by Lady Mary Roth in the early part of the 17th century.
Yes, and I think the dating range is somewhere between 1614 and 24. I think that's the general gist. But people disagree as to precisely
where.
People
disagree, which is why I was very careful on what I said.
Yes.
Because it's always that you will never get two people to agree on anything. We don't have TARDIS. So many things that we cannot be certain of. Current theory is only as good as the information we have as different things are unearthed. Interpreted in a different way.
Yes, because with Love's Victory, we've got two different manuscript versions of the text, which give us a range of information about it. We've got a personal history, quite a complicated personal history for Mary Roth and the family. There's always that temptation to try and be biographical about the way one's interpreting a text like this. Something that is a private event, it creates a lot of scope for interpretation and questioning in that sense. So how were you involved in that? Because it's quite a musical text.
It's a wonderful text. There's nothing that actually survives that goes with it musically, but there are at least, I'm trying to think. I think we had 13 songs in it. Most of which are in the text. There is one point where there's a gap and it says a song is sung.
Yes, before Cupid, the very end of the play, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. So in that instance, Alison Findlay, who's the professor who's been working on editing the text, threw a whole load of different texts at me on the subject of love from Lady Mary's works, also some from William Herbert's work because of their connection. And I looked at what might fit them, and I found a tune called Durrance Mask, which is, Durrance was the house where Lady Mary Roth lived with Robert Roth. And King James visited there often and masks were performed there. Mm. So a piece called Durrance Mask is likely to have a plausible connection to Lady Mary. And it fitted the meter of one of the songs, Who Can Blame Me If I Love. So that was the text I chose for at that point.
To explicate for our listeners, so Love's Victory is a sort of pastoral romance where there's an awful lot of discussion of the nature of love and what it is to be in love with someone, and do they love me back, and I can't tell them, but I must tell them, and a lot of negotiation, and then towards the end of the play, it becomes very active as we hurtle towards this climax of potential tragedy is set up. And the whole thing is set up by Venus and Cupid, who Cupid sort of unleashed. It's like Venus has taken the safety catch off Cupid's bow, and he just goes, shoot everyone with love. And is that a reasonable summary of what happens in the text?
I mean, it's literally, he takes his blindfold off at the beginning, and then it is seeing how many different ways he can, all of the different aspects of love. But with the songs, what I did was to look at the meters of the songs, and then I looked at the musical circle associated with Lady Mary Wroth and the Sidneys. And there are a group of composers who are very active at court at this time, who set many of Philip Sidney's texts, and some also, Robert Jones, for example, dedicates a book of songs to Lady Mary. So we made sure that we had some of his music in it. We had Dowland, both Robert and John. We had some Robert Johnson, because he's very involved in court music. Mm. And Campion and Rossiter, to go with Jones, again, very involved in the same circle. Oh, yes, the other person I used was Martin Pearson, who set some of Foot Greville's music.
Yes.
So again, I was looking for composers who could plausibly have been linked into the family, pieces that might have been known. I was using, on the whole, 16-17 as a cut-off point for the music, apart from the Pearson, which was not printed till 1620, but these things circulated in advance. And I used a lot of the musical banquet, which is printed by Robert Dowland, sets a lot of Sidney texts in the same pentameter as Lady Mary's texts. So I used a lot of those, particularly where the meaning of the song was the same as in both cases.
Because this is an event, this is a text from a potential event from, you know, the early 17th century. We have a flourishing sort of court mask culture at this point. I mean, and a literary set that has been around these families and these figures for a long time. So there are so many potential influences to be sort of sifted through and played with here. I mean, it's a very complicated world. I mean, in terms of context for the listener, we as our reading group have got to about 1604 in terms of detailed reading of all the texts. And I'm sort of looking ahead increasingly with horror at the Jacobean world of just how much stuff there is, because it gets... Yeah, stuff survives. More stuff survives. It's very frustrating because it's just like, how do you sift it all?
you just need more time. Sleeping with wimps.
Yeah.
but no, it is. It's really hard. And so many of these pieces are rich in music. Let me know when you get to the Rape of Lucrece.
There's a reason why we haven't done it yet. The text went into preparation ages ago, and then we hit some hurdles. So I don't know when we're going to do that. But in theory, we should have done it by now, because we've been sort of working our way through a lot of Haywood of late.
Yes. But that like Love's Victory in a different way is a musical.
Oh yeah, and there are so many texts that are like that, especially if you're doing boys' company plays, where, you know, it's basically every act has their big number. It's like, we've got to stop the scene now. Why? Because we must sing. Because you know, they're all boy, singers,
the choristers,
and
yes.
The choristers, and so that's part, probably one of the primary reasons people go to see the show. In fact, some of the boy company shows you have references to. They had an hour's concert before the show started, and you know, you get a full entertainment of all the senses.
Really, get someone to give us money to do that.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Amazing. Yes.
But yeah, depending on the context of the performance, you have different levels of musical interplay going on as well, and different contexts, you know, if it's an indoor theatre or an outdoor theatre, the kind of instruments that are being played, the kind of music that's being played.
Soft or loud music, accordingly.
Mm. So, yeah, in your sort of explorations through sort of early music, do you focus in on an area or do you try to keep everything very expansive or and play around? I mean, do you have a niche within this world or are you trying to keep your options open?
I suppose it's probably Elizabethan and Jacobean that I, but to some extent it's project-based. So if someone wants to know about music from 1535, or I mean we've had a fantastic project over the last couple of years where the Horse Racing Museum in Newmarket got in touch and they wanted music to mark their 350th anniversary of 1681. And so at that point I went down the rabbit hole of songs about horse racing and all things to do with the restoration. I mean, there are wonderful, again, there's a lot of Charles II stuff. Yes, his favourite horse. There are dances named after his favourite horse. There are ballads where you can actually follow the progress of the race and see which horse is ahead of the other one. I do rabbit holes very well, I think. For the Intoxicants project, I looked at music connected with chocolate, coffee, and tea and tobacco in the 16th, 17th, and early 18th centuries.
Yes, because we're very much where we're reading. We're right into the tobacco influx, shall we say, in culture of everyone. Everyone has an opinion on tobacco, for or against,
and that, you know, and they do it in polemics and in song. Yeah, whether it's tobacco is like love, or evilness of it, or I mean, the interesting thing is also the medicinal properties, whether they're ascribed to tobacco or chocolate or coffee. They all seem to cure the same things, actually, as you go through the long list of things. I mean, chocolate is good for the complexion. It's good to help you conceive. It's good.
I'm buying it. I think it's perfectly reasonable.
There's a fantastic ballad from 1652, when the first chocolate coffee house opened in London, with about 20 verses, each of which describes the things that chocolate can cure.
We've just read, this won't get released probably for a while, a play called Lingua, which has a sequence where tobacco turns up. And it is, I mean, it's an incredibly problematic moment, shall we say, with a representation of a Native American talking about tobacco. And, you know, but it's very, very good for you. It will clear your cough. And it feels like an advert from the 1950s for big tobacco at this moment. And it's 400 years old. Yeah, it's a strange moment when sort of time collapsed. And it felt like the 1950s and the 1600s were on top of each other.
That they are the same. Have you come across the anti-mask of the Mask of Flowers?
Not yet. We haven't done many masks.
That's 1614, so you're not up to that. But that has, again, a fantastic and rather xenophobic. The problem, political correctness was not a thing.
No.
But that has this depiction of Kawasha, the god of tobacco. They describe what he's wearing because he's covered in leaves with a chimney on his head. He essentially has a contest with Silenus, the god of wine. And as they're shouting down each other, he has come from a far country to make our nose a chimney.
Yeah, I think we're sort of drawing to the end of the formal part of the chat. Where can we find you and in your various forms online or in real world place?
Through Passamezzo, we have a YouTube channel. Please subscribe to it. We add new music every week. We're on all the usual social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Mastodon, Instagram. And we have a website, Passamezzo, which gives details of our forthcoming performances. I think the next time we're doing something is we're at the British Museum for Histfest in April.
Which is probably about the time this will actually go out. So,
in which case, we will be at the British Museum for his fest. Probably the 23rd of April, but I can't remember the date, but it says on our website.
That will be 2023 for those listening in the future. Listening to past recording. This is the thing. Remember, the podcast will remain online for ages. So it's yes. Always have to remember to mention the year just in case. Yeah. all links to any and all materials will also be available in the show description, so you'll be able to find any updated material on websites there. Well, all that remains is to thank a wonderful guest for joining us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been great to talk.